Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. I've long wanted to sit down with my first two guests on today's show to learn about the strange circular ocean currents that swirl around the North Pacific, bringing Asian debris to Alaska shores, and as we'll hear, bringing pieces of Alaska shipwrecks to Hawaii. I'll have a serious beachcomber who travels far and wide to find these interesting items, and an oceanographer who's used them to change our view of how the oceans work. Kurt Ebbesmeyer is the guy who told us about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. That's the first half. In the second half, my guest is local endurance coach Lisa Keller. You've heard her before on our show with the training calendar, the first Thursday of each month. We're doing that again today, and we'll have Lisa telling a story about her work in an Alaska prison coaching runners. It's all ahead on Outdoor Explorer, Alaska Public Media's audio outdoor magazine. Well, I'm really excited about this segment. I've got two guys that I've wanted to talk to for a long time who are experts on beachcombing and ocean currents and the bizarre stuff you can find on Alaska shorelines and shorelines all around the North Pacific. And it's not an activity you can only do in the summertime. You can go down to the beach and find interesting stuff any time of year. It makes a walk so much more interesting and so much more exciting when you find something cool. On the line is Kurt Ebbesmeyer. He's really a fairly famous guy as an oceanographer who has studied floating debris in the ocean and used that to figure out ocean currents and these mysteries about the sea. And he publishes a newsletter, and he's written about many times. I'm sure many listeners will have read about the sneakers and the rubber duckies. And he's joining us by phone from Vancouver, Washington, Kurt.
Hi, Charles. It's great to be on your program.
All right. Thanks for being here. And in the studio with me is an old friend, Andy Baker, who is an Alaskan clean energy engineer and quite a renaissance man, has done a lot of stuff and travels all over the world and has become really enamored with this sport or hobby of beachcombing. And you actually plan trips around it, right, Andy?
I do now, yeah. Especially Hawaii. Big island, because that's a great place to find things that have floated from all over the world, including Alaska.
Yeah.
There's organized trips now, you can go and join and meet really cool people and basically, clean a beach. But really, for me, it's trying to find some mysterious flotsam that might have an origin you could trace.
Well, and I think about this in terms of all of the Alaskans who go to Hawaii. I mean, I feel like the population of Hawaii must double at spring break. And they're, lie on the beach, maybe do a little surfing. But you're doing something that's actually sort of socially beneficial and cleaning up a beach, and also really fun of finding remote places, because you're looking for beaches that are off the beaten track, right?
That's right. Most of the resorts don't want to locate themselves at a beach where a lot of things are floating up.
Right.
So as it turns out, on Big Island Hawaii, as Kurt has written about in his book and has been to, for example, Kamilo Beach is the favorite, and that's at a very remote spot, about 6 miles, 7 miles north of South Point. There's no development. It's from Nahaleu. It's a 5-mile walk, or you need a Jeep or something. And so it's an expedition just to get in there. And so when you get there, there's not many people, but there's a whole lot of floating objects to check out.
And people might think you're looking for some kind of treasure, but your treasure is just the oddity, what's interesting, right? I mean, it's not like you're looking for something of great value.
Right. We don't expect
a lot of times it's like gold. It's in the eye of the beholder. So you can find things that are worth more than gold in your life.
That's right. And I know, Kurt, you had this, there was this great thing about these bath toys that were floating around in the ocean, and people really got very excited about getting the whole collection and finding them, and that lasted for years, right?
It's still going on. In fact, the tag we'll talk about that you found at Kamilo, that was right near the Exxon Valdez, and so the story really revolves, or one of the stories revolves around what you found down in Hawaii that echoes back to the Exxon Valdez disaster.
Isn't that interesting, the way the ocean holds on to stuff for so long and then spits it out at some random spot, and then a guy like Kurt, who has studied it, can figure out, like, where did it start, what path did it follow, how did it get there? And he's talking about this fishing tag you found, right, Andy?
Yeah, that's one of the objects, and Kurt has written a book called Flotsometrics, and that's really how I got drawn into this study. His book is very fascinating because it's the stories of these floating objects, and through those paths that the objects take, he's been able to basically map out the gyrocurrents. And so, we do find things in Hawaii that have come from Alaska, and you know, there's many objects, including the fish tag from a capsized boat in Valdez. And that was a story that you covered earlier this year.
Yeah. I wrote a column about that, which you can find at our website at outdoorexplored.org. And the neat thing about it was that it started out in Prince William Sound and showed up years and years later on this beach in Hawaii. And Andy was just happened to find it. And you knew to talk to Kurt, and Kurt could tell you how it got there. And so it's this really complex set of events. But how rare is it to find something you can actually track back? Kurt, is that common to find something that you can figure out exactly how it got into the ocean?
Yeah, you can. It's not that uncommon if you get your eyeballs tuned in right. It's like tuning in an old TV set. You get rid of the static, and all of a sudden the story just comes in. And that tag that Andy found, that was only. It only takes like 3 years to drift from Prince William Sound down to Hawaii. It's a remarkably, in terms of the ocean, because it takes 25 years to drift around the planet, only 3 years to get down from the Exxon Valdez down to Camilo, where Andy was walking. So he has a brilliant sense of what you can track, and he called me, and then he dug into where that tag was from and the story behind it, the fisherman who died, and it's an incredible story. So it's not unusual to find something on the beach, particularly ones that have words or numbers on them. So if you see something, and this little tag we're talking about is only the size of a hospital tag that you put around your wrist, so you can really find things that will just light up your life and really change your life.
Interesting. So, and you have used these items floating around to learn about the ocean and the path of the current and the time it takes for things to get from one point to another. Is that something that was, was it something that allowed you to fill in some gaps in our knowledge about the ocean when you first started looking at these items that had fallen off ships and so forth?
Yeah, it filled in a gap that's been known for a century, but it got dropped by the scientific community. They're called gyres, about how the ocean just swirls in great currents, the gyres, and the people that kind of look for these things are called gyrists now. And there's a bunch of scientists that don't believe in gyrists, but I happen to believe that the ocean swirls much of it in circles, great circles. And this tag shows very clearly how you can explain things by gyres. So we're filling in something that our oceanographic ancestors knew about in the 1800s. Derelict vessels would go around in circles, and were seen many times. And ringing bells in the Atlantic, got loose in our big floods, would be seen like 20 times going around. But yet, the scientific community doesn't really recognize that things go around in circles so much.
Yeah, interesting. So there's, I guess, two ways of going about this. One is to go out as a beach cleaner, and we've got a lot of groups in Alaska that do that, and they try to get everything off the beach. And the other is just sort of as a prospector, which I think is what more of us would do as individuals, is going out and sort of looking for things on the beach that might be of interest. And I'm interested, you've done both, right, Andy?
Yes. Yeah, and there's a lot of places in Alaska. Now, we'd be talking about stuff going from Alaska to Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, as Kurt will tell you too, and Chris Pallister knows.
From Gulf of Alaska,
yeah,
Keeper.
Yeah. There's a whole lot of stuff that ends up in Alaska. And a lot of it is... it's carried by the Alaska Gyre, Alaska Current, but then the wind will blow it off in a storm. One great example is Gore Point, which mm-hmm. is across the landmass from Homer. It's like a hook.
And it's on the outside in Gulf of Alaska.
Yeah, and you go there after a storm, and you'll find, tons and tons of stuff blown in not just on the beach, but way in the woods. Mm-hmm. And that stuff has been, you know, traveling around the Alaska Current when it was probably brought there, you know, from the North Pacific Gyre, or maybe possibly somewhere in Alaska, but a lot of it is, you know, Southeast Asia. It's just moving around. And so when you go out on beaches that collect things in Alaska, you could find something from you know, anywhere in the Pacific that's been in the ocean for, could be 20, 30 years, depending on, you know, what it is and how long it lasts. And Kurt's story about the rubber ducks is fascinating because those were bathtub toys.
They're like being shipped on a freighter or something, right?
Yeah, it capsized. Yeah,
and back in 1992, there was a single container that held 29,000 turtles, ducks, beavers, and frogs. And it fell overboard in January, and I think the following summer around Sitka, they were inundated with all these plastic bathtub toys.
They're cute, right?
Yep.
And they're still, 27 years later, people are still finding them?
Yeah, in fact, the story about the tag that went down to Hawaii. Just at the time Andy was talking to me, I got a call from a guy who was studying the oil spills on birds from Exxon Valdez all these years later. And he says, Kurt, is this one of your toys? And lo and behold, on the 25th anniversary of the spill, he showed me a picture of a green turtle he'd just found.
Isn't that amazing?
Incredible, the serendipity, if you know what's on the beach.
And stuff lasts so long, yeah. Hey, it's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfworth. We were talking about beach combing and all the odd objects that are floating around in the ocean that can stay out there for decades, and you can find them. And every one of them is in a sense, a ship, a message in a bottle, because it started out somewhere, it ends up with you, and you can wonder about how it got there. And the guy I have on the phone with me from Washington State is Kurt Ebbesmeyer. He's an oceanographer who has studied this for many years, publishes a newsletter. He wrote a book called Flotsometrics in the Floating World, One Man's Obsession with Runaway Sneakers and Rubber Ducks, Revolutionized Open Ocean Science. And in the studio is Andy Baker. He's an Alaskan clean energy engineer who kind of built his own obsession and now travels around looking for this stuff. And we can do it too. It's really fun. This is also a big problem, right? Because there is so much stuff out there and it stays for so long. And there, you know, sometimes there'll be a big incident like the Japanese tsunami that dumps a lot in at once. And that sort of follows out for years as we see where it ends up. And then also there's just a lot of fishing gear and garbage that gets dumped in the ocean, right? And so you were mentioning Gore Point, Andy, and I've been out there, and it was when it was a mountain. I mean, it was an unbelievable quantity of stuff. 99% of that is of no interest, right? It's just buoys and ropes and garbage. And so do you go sort of sifting through looking for something, or how do you find things?
Well, a lot of it is fishing gear. Like I did a cleanup down in Sitka on a cruise off island with the Sitka Sound Science Center. We had maybe 60 people. Mm. And so you find ropes and buoys. But the plastic items, some of them are extremely durable. And that's one of the lessons you learn is that, my God, when you throw a piece of plastic in the ocean,
it's there forever.
Yeah, it's not just going to, it can break apart into smaller pieces. The other thing you often see is fish bites, especially in Hawaii. You know, like a piece of a Clorox bottle has just got lacerated outside of it by fish bites. So animals are.
They're ingesting this stuff.
Yeah, they selectively choose certain colors. And, you know, that's really bad news out in, like, the Midway Island, where you have, like, you know, red and bright blue cigarette lighters that albatross are ingesting, thinking it's shrimp or something. And so by the time it makes it to a collector beach, it's already been sort of filtered out by nature and broken down to some extent. But then you're left with these pieces. And as Kurt said, if you find something with writing on it or a manufacturer, you have a real chance of perhaps finding the origin of it. And Kurt and his associates can actually, you know, using a Oscar simulator, you know, come up or predict a path that might have taken. And, you know, Kurt can talk more about how that works. But then you can unlock, you know, the possible mystery of where this thing came from.
Right, right. And how often are you able to do that, Andy? I mean, when you're in your explorations and you're going specifically to do this to different beaches around the Pacific, How often are you able to find something that actually tells a story and reads back to an earlier
Well, it's rare to find something with a, like, you know, the boat name and the phone number, like the Fate Hunter tag. But the tsunami debris often has manufacturer's name on it, which, you know, Japanese or Southeast Asia.
So if it's something for somebody's garage in Japan, you can pretty sure it's from the tsunami.
Yeah, we found one of Kurt's associates, Noni Sanford, who beachcombs Camilo at least once a month. She found a shopping basket panel that was from a specific grocery store in Sendai, a shopping basket, and we know that it got hit by the tsunami, and it broke that basket into pieces. And there was the square panel with the name of the store. And so, you know, that's a real find.
We found about 100 different boats that came from the tsunami. The Japanese Coast Guard has on record at least 400 vessels that they were tracking right off the coast there. So there's an incredible amount. And we also found, you know, where those Dungeness crab pots that have those little orange tags that we're talking about. One of those, two of those were found out at Midway Island that Andy was talking about, and they drifted from Oregon all the way after 4 years landed in Midway. That's incredible. We verified the drift with a computerized model. We can do a lot if we have some words and numbers on things.
Yeah, there was a very touching documentary film I saw about people trying to bring objects back to the Japanese. You know, a soccer ball or something else that they found, and I guess it's probably really difficult and probably at this point maybe too late to be doing that. But it's, you know, that tragedy dumped a lot of stuff into the ocean, and some very unusual objects showed up on the West Coast, as I understand it, right, Kurt?
Yeah, they found almost a whole shrine, the top part of a Japanese Shinto shrine. And they actually took it back and rebuilt the shrine. There was towns, you know, maybe 20,000 people that rebuilt their city after being inspired by a returned soccer ball or a basketball in which the whole team was wiped out. So I don't think it's too late.
Okay, wow. So, Kurt, you sort of form a node or a nexus for all of the people finding these things around the world to kind of report them and to network with one another as to what people are finding. So the objects go in the ocean, they spread out in these seemingly chaotic ways, but actually by patterns, and then they get reported back to you and you figure out what the patterns are. So that's a really interesting role you have. How many different people are you in contact with? And you know, are you receiving these reports all the time from different places?
Well, yeah, beachcombing for me is like going down, work in my basement here, and I just go down and turn on the computer, and the beach is right on my screen because I get reports from beachcombers worldwide. I sift them down into the ones I can trace and put them out in my newsletter, and you can find it at flotsammetrics.com.
Uh-huh. And then you send out this beachcombers alert newsletter, which I guess is a little bit... It's sort of the old-fashioned way of communicating, but it's just full of stories about different things that have been found. The Beachcombers Alert.
Beachcombers Alert is digital. It's also paper, and I think I just mailed out my 87th issue over the last 21 years. They come out 4 times a year, and that's kind of what I do. So we have beachcombers worldwide sending in an amazing amount of just incredible stories.
Yeah. Are you interested in hearing from listeners who might find some odd or interesting thing with words on it?
Oh, definitely, because that's why I'm on the program. I want people to report in. That's how we learn about the ocean, because it's a neglected aspect of science. What's actually floating on the ocean is sort of like an Agatha Christie novel. How do you hide something? You hide it in plain sight. And what floats on the ocean is virtually ignored by modern science.
Yeah. And these patterns are so, I mean, it seems like the hand of God is out there moving things around, but of course it's not. It's just the way that the water moves. But Andy was telling me about a couple of spots in Hawaii where indigenous people would actually use the currents for communication, right, Andy? I mean, there's a consistent movement of stuff from one spot to another, and I'm not sure if I'm remembering it right. Tell me about that again.
Yeah, that's right. And Kurt wrote about that in his book. So the trade winds push the current against the east coast of Hawaii, and it slams into the point that's just north of Puna, And so from Puna down to South Point, you have a very strong current coming down. And the Hawaiians had figured out that if you tossed like a gourd in the ocean with a message from Puna at a certain time, it would float down, and the high tides come in cycles of three. So if you put it in at the lowest high tide, there's a very high chance that at the highest high tide, 36 hours later, it would land at Kamilo. And so they would, you know, they'd paddle up from Kamilo on a journey, and to tell their cousins they made it safe, they would throw a gourd in. And then it became messages for, you know, lovers and families. Mm-hmm. So this was the first sort of, you know, telegram system. Of course, the current only goes one way, but it was so consistent, and they had studied it. And that's fascinating to me, because that means that they had figured out, you know, how long an object would take to float, you know, from Puna down. And that's where it kind of all starts off offshore. It shows up, and then the wind blows it in. So as chaotic and random as it is, there are some patterns there that are pretty amazing. And of course, the high tide at Kamilo is when this kind of lagoon offshore floods, and the current slows down and just blows this big waft of stuff in. So it comes in pulses. And so in order for a floating object really to land there, it's got to be drifting by at high tide.
So you got to know when to throw it in the water.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, the indigenous people saw these patterns and figured it out. And there were all kinds of things like that when people were a little bit closer to the natural world that they understood that we may have forgotten about.
Yeah, and there's a lot.
It goes a lot deeper, because the kings in Hawaii would post sentries up higher in the mountains, and they would watch for these giant pine trees that wash down in floods in North America. It only takes a year to drift down, and some of those pine trees were 100 feet long. And if the king got a couple of them, he could build a war canoe and go conquer another island. So what washed up was a lot more than just messages. They knew that stuff, big trees were washing down from land far 2,000 miles to the east. So it had to do with a lot of colonizing Hawaii. So,
wow, and here and
pretty well documented.
And here in Alaska, the people of the North Slope, where there were no trees, used firewood to warm themselves. And where did they get it? Well, it came down the rivers, like the Yukon River, the Kuskokwim River, and then the prevailing current brought it up around the Arctic Ocean coast and the Chukchi and Bering Sea and on the shore, and that's where they got driftwood. So, yeah, the ocean is kind of taking care of us, distributing stuff, and I suppose also seeds and all of the biological things that go from place to place. So interesting, and a topic that is really, really neglected, that we really don't spend that much time talking about. We're talking about it today with Kurt Ebbesmeyer, who's an oceanographer, is publisher of the Beachcombers Alert, and studies the drifting objects in the ocean, and Andy Baker, an Alaskan who is an enthusiast for this topic and travels on beachcombing expeditions, and he's also an engineer. The main current, Kurt, that feeds us here in Alaska is I guess a circular current in the North Pacific that's going counterclockwise. So the first stop, I mean, I guess there's no first or second because it's a eternal circle, but I mean, you could say it's good. First stop Hawaii, second stop U.S. West Coast, then through British Columbia, Southeast Alaska, and then here to South Central Alaska, and then sort of a left turn back downward. Or how does that big circle work?
Well, just if your listeners can just visualize Japan where the tsunami was, that's kind of like an expressway, and it heads right over to about Sitka. And then it splits, and half of it or so goes down to Hawaii and back to Japan. That's the big gyre. It takes about 6 years to go around. And from Japan to Sitka, the other half turns left and goes north, up toward Kodiak, out toward Dutch Harbor, and then back over to Kamchatka and back to Japan. That's about a three-year circuit. So it's a very nice clockwork. So it's a wonderful mechanism to keep in your mind that it's a three-year gyre that runs from Japan over to the listeners and around, and then there's a six-year gyre that runs over to the same listeners but turns right and goes back to Japan, Philippine Islands, and comes back after 6 years. So there's this 3-6-year wonderful clockwork.
So this particular object that Andy found in Hawaii to get from Alaska to Hawaii, would it have had to ride the northern gyre and then sort of disembark from that one and sort of change trains and get on the southern gyre to make it down there?
You got it exactly right, Charles. It rode the three-year gyre kind of like halfway down, switched stations, and then rode the six-year gyre on down to Hawaii. It took about 3 years to get down, which is a remarkable journey in itself. So a lot of objects don't just ride around one gyre. They're kind of like riding the MTA. And he never returned.
Right.
Fate is still unknown.
Well, I was because I've heard about that if any circle has a middle, so there's a donut hole to this conveyor belt. It's kind of like we used to have these old conveyor belts in the airport. If something fell off in the middle, it would just stay there until an employee came and took it off, right?
It really does. I noticed so much stuff in the middle that I named it the garbage patch a long time ago because the rubber duckies were collecting there. And a lot of the stuff that comes down to Camilo just gets kicked out of the garbage patch and goes on down to Hawaii. The garbage patch is about, I'd say, halfway between Camilo and San Francisco. And it's about 800 miles around, so it's three times the size of Texas, and that's where Mother Nature collects an awful lot of the debris, and the albatrosses go fly across it and pick up stuff and bring it back to their chicks, and then the chicks die. So
yeah.
Mother Nature's very good about collecting things.
Well, and this is the thing, and I read about the garbage patch years ago, probably something you wrote, and I imagined it was just looked like the city dump, but actually it's, and people think, well, why can't we go and clean it up? But actually, it's not very dense, right? It's a pretty dispersed area of garbage, and it doesn't all float at the surface.
Yeah, the whole water column, about 15,000 feet, as high as Mount Rainier, is infected. But the point is, it is dispersed, but then Mother Nature reconcentrates it even more down at Camilo. So we can clean up the ocean by going to these collection spots along the shoreline, and 90% of the half the flotsam is on 10% of the shoreline. So, and Camilo's one of those collection spots. So, the more often we go there, the cleaner the ocean will get.
Mm-hmm. Andy, you're traveling down to Hawaii to do some more of this exploration, prospecting work, whatever you would like to call it, and you'll be going out to some of these remote beaches, which I think our listeners love the idea of going somewhere remote, somewhere other people don't go. Any other spots? I mean, do you do this in Alaska as well? Do you go out and kind of look for things and think about like where the best collecting spots are?
Sometimes I'll go out solo. I think the funnest thing for me is to join a group, because if you're going to clean up an area, you need a lot of people and a lot of help, and that's kind of when you can get into those more remote spots. I mean, Gower Point's a tough place to get to.
Yeah,
solo trip.
You need a helicopter or a really stout boat to get out there.
Yeah. Or in Hawaii, four-wheel drive. So on the Big Island, there's Hawaii Wildlife Fund has regular cleanups. There's one March 3rd at Camilo, for example, and they might get 70 to 100 people. You might have 12 off-road vehicles, and you go down there. And if you get there early, or say even the day before, you can camp out. You can get first, dibs at, perhaps the best treasures. And that Fate Hunter tag was actually found together with Noni Sanford, who she just goes out and beachcombs, and she's an expert at finding those special items that could be traced. And so, cleaning the beach is sort of one activity. Beachcombing is sort of what you do while you're cleaning or before you're cleaning. Because, when you start cleaning, you kind of want to just get everything together. But you find those things. And so it's also, I know down in, I've done some beachcombing down across the Strait of Juan de Fuca from Port Angeles. And there's a lot of stuff that blows in there. And you can walk for miles and find things that came in from the oceans and from the Columbia River area. And
so these special collector beaches are the place to go and maybe go. You feel a little bit more positive if you're actually cleaning it up and doing something for the place rather than just sifting through it, right?
Yeah, it's good to take stuff off the beach. I can tell you the last time I went to Camilo, we showed up, and it, as Kurt will tell you, you get there and you're just shocking, because the high tide has brought in, one or two or three foot deep piles of stuff. and you get 100 people going and get them fired up, and you can really clean up a lot of debris. So they're, you know, they're.
But it's not a one-time thing. The next tide, there'll be more.
Exactly. It just keeps keeps.
That's the point. Is that's why you have to keep going out if you want to clean the ocean. You really should be going out to Camilo about every couple of weeks just to clean up those big piles. But you really, Andy brings up a great point. You need two kinds of people. You need the cleaners who really don't look at each item that they pick up. They're just after tonnage.
Yep.
But you also have to have people like Noni who sort of high-grade the stuff and look for interesting objects. And she knows, for example, what I'm looking for. And then I asked Andy one time, you got anything? Look in Noni's bucket there. And that's where he found, I think, the Fate Hunter tag.
Mm-hmm.
And that became a whole story. So you need the other kind, the prospector. So you need both the tonnage people and you need the prospector people.
Well, if you've got 100 sets of eyes picking up everything, you might increase your chances as well. I wanted to ask you, Kurt, why is it that there are certain beaches that are such extraordinary collectors? You know, I think of the beaches where I spend time in the summer, and occasionally something will wash up, but it's not like, you know, Gore Point, which Andy mentioned, which is just buried, you know, or this Camilo Beach you talked about, that it's so frequently buried, needs to be washed, cleaned up every couple of months. What causes these particular places to be so exceptionally heavy in debris?
Well, it's sort of like fishing. I don't understand fish very well, but I do know that there are fishing holes. I've been going to the same lake for 38 years every year, and I know that there's fishing holes. So if I want to catch a tonnage, I just I'll put my line in a fishing hole and I'll fish for 10 minutes, then I'll go to the next hole, the next hole, the next hole. The whole point is I know where the holes are and I know where flotsam collects. So if I'm in a particular area, I'll zip from one beach to the next to see where the stuff has been collecting, and then focus on those. So the best thing to do is talk to local beachcombers, and you'll find out, well, where is the stuff? Where are the fishing holes? And fishermen will often tell you. So you take a huge lake, and there's most all the fishing hole, all the fish will be in just concentrated in maybe a dozen holes, and then that's just the nature.
Just the geography of it, huh?
It's like asking an elephant, well, why are you eating here?
In terms of this research, Kurt, what are the questions that you still want to answer? Are you just waiting, sitting back and waiting for the nature to tell you things, or do you have questions or issues that you're trying to figure out?
Well, I'm trying to figure out where things really do concentrate, and I'm doing an article now on, how do you clean the ocean? But you don't want to put plastic in the ocean to clean up plastic. So I'm looking for, you know, ways that we can do crowdsourcing, and so I'm starting a Kickstarter program where a bunch of us go worldwide and visit these places where things collect. And a lot of them are near big cities, so you can go. One of the nicest ones is what they call mudlarking in Cornwall, England. You go up the Thames River, and you can find things from ancient Roman times that have been washing up on the Thames shoreline for millennia. So there's lots of places that are really interesting to go, close to big cities. So if you got a few hours, get out of the airport and go to one of the collection spots like Cornwall. Get on the beach and just poke around, and you'd just be amazed.
Neat. And this is kind of what you've been doing, Andy, traveling the world, beachcombing and looking for interesting stuff. Are you still? Is this still caught your? Still something you want to keep doing?
Oh yeah. I'm real interested in it. And my own work at the Sea Life Center, we were trying to figure out how hot water was moving.
Right.
The ocean.
This is a whole additional story that Andy built the heat pump system at the Sea Life Center that takes the warmth of Resurrection Bay to warm the Sea Life Center in Seward. Yeah.
Yeah, the design team I led, and we were trying to figure out this mystery, and that's where Kurt's book came in.
Oh.
I was totally baffled at how did this Resurrection Bay get hot in November? And it turns out that the way that the plastics move in the ocean is also very similar to the surface heat.
The way the warmth moves.
Yeah, so warm water from the Philippines goes around the Big Gyre and makes its way up to Alaska, and that's why Prince William Sound bays are ice-free. And, you know, why Valdez is ice-free and Seward is ice-free. That's that ocean heat. That's the same currents that are bringing the plastic.
The pulses of warmth that show up there in the fall. Yeah.
And so Kurt's sort of mapping these gyres based on the flow of plastics and the orbit times. That also tells us a lot about how ocean heat is moving. And that's really powerful because that's a lot of energy that's moving around. And if you're trying to heat a building.
So when you're heating the Seward Sea Life Center with warmth from the Philippines, essentially, they got there for free.
It's solar heat from the equator that's migrated up and delivered free of charge. And you realize that connection, it's extremely powerful, but it's been mapped out from these pieces of plastic, you know, and so these journeys that they're taking are real important because, you know, that unlocks this mystery of the movements and how they cross from gyre to gyre. And you know, Kurt could talk a little bit about what's called the Grand Tour, where a piece of something goes around the world.
Yeah.
And that's really amazing.
Yeah, he said 25 years. Amazing. Well, and we're kind of out of time. Just such a fascinating topic. And it's one of these things where you pull back each layer of the onion and you find another one and another one and another one into these mysteries of the Earth. And it's really glad you guys are trying to decipher them. Kurt Ebbesmeyer, an oceanographer based in Washington, who publishes the Beachcombers Alert newsletter and the book Floatsometrics and the Floating World. Thanks for being with us, Kurt.
Thanks, Charles. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, and Andy Baker here in Anchorage for one of his brief stints from his world travels. Andy, as you can hear, is traveling all over the place with his many enthusiasms, one of which is beachcombing. Thanks for being with us today, Andy.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
All right, please stick with us. Outdoor Explorer will continue.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and it's time for our training calendar. First Thursday of the month, I sit down with Lisa Keller, a coach who has multi-sport training of Alaska. She works with people like me, the old broken down people who want to do triathlons, and probably also young athletes too. And we decided we would come back every month and talk about where you should be if you were planning to do a big endurance event. You don't want to just think about it a month out. You got to think about it well in advance. And we've been doing this for a few months, so hopefully folks have been listening and getting ready. And you've been working towards the Lava Man, which is a Hawaiian race, triathlon, but a lot of Alaskans go to it.
Oh, yeah. It's last year there were 300 Alaskans.
And wow, that's amazing, isn't it?
I know. I anticipate there will be more this year.
There should be a Lava Man airplane that goes down.
It feels like that when we all go over the week before. You know, it's just full of people doing Lava Man.
Neat. So it's we're about 4 weeks out now?
Yep. It's at the end of this month, so it'll be the 25th of March.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very close. So right now you're looking at tapering for this race. You might be doing your last big brick, which is very race specific and has a lot of race pace in it.
And that's where you're combining two types of workouts.
Your bike and your run. So there's a couple things that you are going to be anticipating, whether it's a wetsuit legal race or not. And generally, this is a wetsuit legal race. A wetsuit definitely helps you. Even though it takes a little bit of time to get off, you expend less energy, you float better, and especially if you're not a very strong swimmer, a wetsuit, a sleeveless preferably, would be what you would want to use.
Hmm. So it's floating makes it easier to swim, and obviously the cold water, even if it's Hawaiian water, is going to take energy out of your body.
Right, and typically the temperature is 76, 77 degrees. The cutoff for a wetsuit is 78 degrees. There's only been 1 year I've ever done it where it was not wetsuit legal. So most of the time you can wear a wetsuit and it's a good idea to do it. So
now when you're getting ready for an event that's far in the future and you want to tune up your technique, like if you're thinking about the Tour of Anchorage and it's the fall, then you could be thinking about improving your ski technique. But when it's a month out, is it kind of too late for that?
It's too late. And especially as we get older, it's very much harder to change our technique. We're kind of already hardwired to do certain things. So by this point, you're not really looking at changing any technique. the big thing I would say is if you are not comfortable in the water, you're still going to have to spend an extra amount of time in the water that people who are comfortable in the water normally wouldn't have to do. So that would be the one thing. It could be working on technique. It could be working a little bit, definitely more on fitness, but you just have to be comfortable in the water.
And are you still doing really hard workouts at this point?
Yes, at this point, up until the kind of the magic day is 10 days out before the race is your last race that makes, or your last workout that makes any physiological difference for the day of the race.
Mm-hmm.
And as we go through this month, each workout contributes a little bit less because you're getting hopefully to your peak.
Right.
And so you're getting little, just little tiny gains as you go. So your last big brick should be maybe 2 to 3 weeks out from the race. So that's, you know, how much time you think it's going to take you to bike, how much time you think it's going to take you to run. Those are together, including a lot of pace, your effort that you're going to be using.
Okay. Now let's talk about something in the midsummer. The Mayor's Marathon happens right around the solstice. Hopefully you've gotten some pretty good distance in by now, right?
Yes. Hopefully by the end of this month, the end of this cycle of training, you'd be up around 3 hours of running. And that's just endurance-based running. There's no really pace associated with it. I always say it's conversational pace. You should be able to talk while you're running that whole 3 hours.
If you're running for 3 hours, hopefully you have a friend because it's going to be boring.
Yes, exactly. It makes it a lot more fun if you have a friend doing this with you. Then it becomes time. This is really the last cycle of base. And then you also want to start in your midweek run starting to introduce marathon pace so that you're getting used to how fast you're going to run during the race and you're practicing that pace. So I like to do a run in midweek that's maybe up to an hour and a half but includes maybe like 20 minutes of marathon pace and then maybe you go 10 minutes of half marathon pace and then 5 minutes of tempo. So you're getting progressively faster as you go through
tempo
that hour
being
and a half.
The sort of as fast as you normally want to run.
Right. Tempo is generally between 10K pace and half marathon pace.
Okay.
So it's a somewhat hard effort. And if you're going on the talk test, you can talk, but you don't feel like talking.
Right. So I know pacing is super important. If you're running by yourself, it's hard to do because how do I know what my marathon pace is, right, until I've done a couple of them?
Right. Another way to find out your marathon pace is you can do a 2-mile time trial, and then there's all kinds of great online calculators that will tell you, okay, if I do a 2-mile in this time, my marathon right now should be this time. And so then it gives you a whole column of different distances and the paces you should be able to do based off of that 2-mile.
So to do that time trial, find a route that's 2 miles or go to the dome and run the track.
Yep.
And to see what your time is and to run it as fast as you can.
Correct.
Which means don't run as fast as you can from the beginning, but run as fast as you think you can do.
You have learned a few things over the years.
I did that with you.
Yeah. That's right. You don't want to go out super fast in the beginning and just be crawling over the line.
Right, right. So then you can sort of, that will tell you your pace and then use some tools that you can get online or joining a group like yours.
Correct.
To figure out, like, sometimes a faster pace is going to help, sometimes a slower pace, but you know where you are compared to your sort of where your sort of parameters are.
Right. You can make a plan from that.
Mm-hmm. So there are events, obviously, after the Mayor's Marathon.
Mm-hmm. There's the next big one after Mayor's would probably be Mount Marathon. So Mount Marathon is definitely time, and, you know, it's March, so you people actually go up on Bird Ridge and Flat Top all winter long. So, but you're definitely starting to get some elevation in your training. Mm-hmm. You're doing some hikes. It doesn't have to be super intense at this point, but you should definitely be starting to get out there and doing some hikes and some runs that are, you know, up to an hour, hour and a half, depending on how long it's going to take you to do Mount Marathon.
That uphill running is quite different from anything else you do.
Yeah, yeah. So
because especially when it's sustained like that, it's not like up and down like in a ski trail.
Exactly. So you really have to work on that power hiking and getting used to being your back kind of bent over and your back gets tired and sore doing that. So you have to, it's like being an arrow for a triathlete, you know, same thing. You've got to get your back adapted to that position and get strong for that position. So again, also strength training becomes very important at this phase in Mount Marathon training. And so you'd be doing a lot of core strengthening stuff. You'd be doing a lot of plyometrics are really good because that power off the ground is going to be really helpful to you.
All right. Well, another great installment from Lisa Keller from Multisport Training of Alaska for our training calendar. We'll be back again first Thursday of next month, you will have followed all of her instructions and be in great shape, right? Yeah. Nobody ever diverges.
No, nobody does.
Yeah, yeah. All right, stick with this as Outdoor Explorer continues. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. For the rest of the show, we're focusing on one guest, Lisa Keller. She's a well-known runner in Anchorage and a professional coach for adults who want to run faster or participate in biathlon. But Lisa is also a volunteer, helping prisoners improve their fitness. We're going to hear that story, recorded at the Trail Tales event put on by Alaska Trails, which we often feature on the show, and you can find out more about that on our site, outdoorexplorer.org. Here's Lisa Keller.
So I was born 2 months before the 1964 earthquake, which was not really exciting for me, but was pretty exciting for my parents. So, and my parents had come up the year before from Palo Alto, but my dad was from Montana, and he just had this really deep frontier sense of the outside, and he loved being outdoors. And so he took my brother and I outside hiking and camping and skiing all the time. So we were really exposed to a lot. And Anchorage was pretty wild back then. There were some serial killers around and there were wild animals and really crazy trails, and our parents would let us explore. And they gave us a lot of opportunities to enjoy nature and to pursue the things we love. They always encouraged us. So I was really lucky, like Steve said, to be able to make that into a business, into something I love to do, be outside, be in nature, help other people connect to each other, because connections to me are really important, having been born in this community and making it my home for 53 years now. So in 2012, I was asked to be the head coach for a new program out at Highland Prison. And Tim Alderson was working as an intern in the mental health unit at that time, and he decided to start a program for his master's thesis, and it was a running program for the female inmates, to see what their response was to running. And he looked at four indicators of health: physical, mental, social, and environmental. And I don't think it's a surprise to anybody who's active here that, you know, 12 weeks at the end of that program, we had a 5K, and all four of those indicators in all 25 women improved immensely. So it was a pretty powerful program to us. So we decided to start that on, we have like two sessions a year. And in the spring, when the snow melts, the women go outside and run their workouts on what I call the shortest trail in Anchorage. It's one of the most beautiful, though. It sits right at the opening of the Eagle River Valley. There's mountains everywhere. You feel like you're in nature, except for the barbed wire along the fences. So they run on this essentially 337-meter dirt trail. It has a little bit of rock in it. And then when we do our races, we've gotten permission to run the inside perimeter of the prison. It's 800 meters long. Again, it's a dirt trail, it's rocky, a little bit of grass, there's a little bit of concrete in it. So it's a really powerful thing to go and watch these races and watch these women accomplish this. I'm really lucky to have a great group of female coaches out there, many of them who are avid trail runners, and there's a lot in the audience today. I'm really excited to see you here. And I was talking to a few of them, and you know, they really have heartfelt feelings about this program and what it does for the women. But for themselves personally, like Jackie describes running in the mountains and feeling both small and insignificant, but at the same time powerful and strong. And then Karen and Ellen both talked about joy and peace and solitude and working through problems in the mountains when they're running. And then Paula had lost a sister, and it really helped her running in the mountains to work through those emotions of losing her sister. But what all four of them talked about were the connections to the people that they had in the running community, in the mountain running community, in the ultra running community, and how strong those connections were and how they helped them get through tough times in their lives. So super important. So not all of us were really, heavily encouraged sometimes. We had different levels of encouragement in our families. But our parents all opened doors and allowed us to walk through these doors and have a better experience in our life. That's not the case for probably 99% of the women at Highland Prison. And so this is a story really about Gina. She's one of our runners. She was born to two drug-addicted parents. Her mother's actually been sober for 8 years now. But at the time, when she was an infant, her mother had 5 children. She lost all her parental rights to those 5 children. And so Gina ended up in foster care. And she was in foster care for her whole 18 years. She does not have good experiences in foster care. She remembers one good experience in foster care, one good foster family. In the rest, she saw abuse. She was abused. She was never encouraged to do anything. She was never exposed to nature. No one ever told her she was a good person. What she feels like she was a paycheck to people. And that's just a really sad way to go through your whole life. So she was in foster care in Anchorage for the first 10 years of her life. And then she went out to Wasilla, and she was in foster care out in Wasilla. And about that time, when she was 13 or 14, her dad came back into her life. And, you know, for all his drama and trauma in his life, he actually did give her a little support that she hadn't had to this point. And she had really kind of already developed a bunch of fear inside of herself. And I don't know if it was fear of failure, fear of succeeding, or just fear of life itself. A lot of it was, I think. But her dad kind of encouraged her. He had actually gone to East High, she told me, and I went and checked my yearbook because I went to East High, and he was a senior when I was a freshman. And he had played basketball and run track, so he encouraged her to do those things. And he would come to her meets, and he would come to her games, and she'd give her pointers about what to do, and she remembers these pointers. And she really felt like that was like a high point of her life, and she felt good about those years with him. When she was 18, at that time, when she turned 18, you're just out of the foster system. So she was thrown out of the foster system, and she lived with her dad at first because she really felt like she needed to take care of him and be with him. And he has since, though her mother is sober, he has since had an alcohol-related incident that he's actually institutionalized and brain dead. And so she's now obviously lost that connection with him. But she stayed with him until an old boyfriend came into town, and old boyfriends are never any good, really. And this kid had been a good kid when they were in high school, and she had been a good kid. She had never been arrested. She had drank a beer once and smoked pot once. That's all she had done, and that's amazing to really escape foster care and not have had a drug problem to begin with from that. But he had been out fishing, and he came back, and he was addicted to cocaine. So she went on a drug run with him, and she met his drug dealer, and that was the beginning of a lot of the pain in her life. So not only did that drug dealer introduce her to meth and heroin, but he became her boyfriend, and they had a child together. That child's 8 and a half right now, and he's doing pretty good. But they had this child together, and then he isolated her in a family compound out in Wasilla, and they were all pretty much criminals there. And so she felt like further isolated and fearful. She was always looking over her shoulder because, you know, they were selling drugs, and that's a scary life to be in. And so that fear and paranoia grew, and it grew with the drug use. I mean, the meth and the heroin really made it worse. She never had to pay for drugs, she told me. She was just supplied drugs. Eventually, she left that without him, came back to Anchorage. In Anchorage, her parents, or her family, became increasingly concerned about her because she was just falling into this abyss of paranoia and fear, and so they had her committed to API. When she got out of API, she immediately went on a meth binge, and within 11 hours of leaving API, she committed her crime. Her crime is a pretty heinous crime, and it's a crime that she hasn't been sentenced yet, but it's a crime that could get her a life sentence at Highland Prison. So she's 30 years old now. This happened when she was 24, and she could be one of those long-time, you know, people that we see out there who are 50 or 60 or 70 years old now. So the first 6 months at Highland, she was in the mental health unit. She was completely disconnected from reality. She wasn't even sure that what she had done was real. She told me, she goes, even afterwards, she didn't really feel like it was real. It was like a dream. So she was in the mental health unit for 6 months, and when she came to us and the other coaches who are here will remember this. She was just all withdrawn, tiny, her head was down. She's smaller than me anyway. She's like 5 feet tall and 100 pounds. She looked like a child, and you look at her and you can't imagine her doing this horrible crime, but she did. And so she had still all that fear that she was holding in herself, but it was so clear how athletic she was. I mean, she could do the running drills, she could do the ladder drills, she was so fast. And as she started gaining confidence over the years in our program, she started to decide to really challenge herself and push back at all that fear, which she did. She pushed back successfully. And before you knew it, she had wiped out our records. And this started a year ago. So in the fall, a year ago, she ran a 10K in 49:22 around that 800-meter dirt track inside the prison. 49:22, first runner in our program ever to break 50 minutes. In this past spring, she ran a 22:01 5K, which would have placed her 15th overall female at the Heart Run this past year. And I can see some of you recognize times, and you're getting it, you know. This past fall, she ran a 1:49:56 half marathon. That's 25 laps around that 800-meter track. 1:49:56. She broke our previous record by 20 minutes. Huge. She annihilated it. So the other great thing about her is she's become this great leader of our culture. And in our running group, they see disrespecting the running program is like way bigger deal to them than getting a parole violation or being thrown in the hole. Like if you disrespect the running program, if you try to take advantage of it, they don't want you anymore. And they've really developed this great culture. So Gina right now dreams about running the Boston Marathon. And she dreams about going out with all these coaches who have helped her connect to life and connect to each other and who believe in her. We believe in her. No one's believed in her before. And running the trails with us in the Chugach. And she wants to go over to Kona and do the Lava Man triathlon with the 300-400 other Alaskans that go every March to do this triathlon. It would be her first triathlon if she can do it. But right now she's running around the shortest trail in Anchorage, round and round and round. And after her last race, after that half marathon, she crossed the line, and she had really had to dig deep for those last two laps because we knew she could break 150, and we told her that in the last two laps. And she dug deep. She pushed back at that fear, and she dug deep, and she broke that 150 mark. And she crossed the line. We're all crying, and she's crying. And then she stops, and she looks up at the mountains. So just all right there, and she says, "I love this life." Yeah, we all love this life. Welcome to this life, Gina. Thank you.
Well, that's all for today's show. I want to thank my first guests, Andy Baker, who's a beachcomber and clean energy engineer, and Kurt Ebelsmeyer, the oceanographer, who joined us from Washington. And then, of course, you heard from Lisa Keller of Multisport Training of Alaska. Our producer for Outdoor Explorer is Eric Bork. Assistant producer is Hannah Duro. My name is Charles Wolfort. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.